your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, and no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, and Charlotte Littlefield is with me tonight. Welcome, Charlotte.
Thank you, George. Good evening.
Okay, and we've got one of the finest guests that we've ever had on our program, and I mean, she's a really fine and a stand-up lady. And welcome to our program, Dr. Judy Wood.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
She's the author of Where Did the Towers Go? And also, she's an engineer. Tell us a little bit about your background, your professional background, and bring us up to date on that.
Let's see. I have a bachelor's degree in civil engineering, structural engineering, and a master's degree in engineering mechanics, which is like applied physics, and then a PhD in materials engineering science. And I have approximately 40 years of experience in forensic engineering and science. That's my line of work, is being able, and also image analysis, being able to identify what happened.
Right. We have your full bio up there right now this evening, so they'll be able to dig down into that. We have, of course, your different pages, your book page and your home page, and we have all of that up at the present time, so they'll be able to see that online. Doctor, where were you on the day of 9/11 when this event happened there in New York City where the attack occurred? Where were you at, and what were you doing?
Well, I was at home initially because I taught a class late in the evening. I was a faculty member at a university. And I was in, you know, I was already up, but as a alarm, I had my radio kick on an obnoxious radio station to make sure I got up. And I was in a different room, and the radio kicked on, and they're talking about, like, you know, some... But he had a party last night, made a wrong turn, and ran their airplane into a building. Yeah, like you're waiting for a punchline that never came. It was like a sick joke. And it was stranger and stranger, and I was skeptical from the beginning. And then I finally, turned on a TV set and saw some action. And they said that the Pentagon had been hit. Well, I need more data to confirm this. And my parents lived near the Pentagon, so I called them to see if they could see fighter jets overhead. And my mom answered the phone, looked out, nope, she couldn't see fighter jets overhead, and she became skeptical too. Then I went into campus and was in the faculty conference room, and they were, of course, showing this view of the buildings turning into powder in midair. And I looked around the room, like, you know, you guys aren't buying this, are you? I didn't say that, but that was the expression on my face, as though I believe we were being played a trick, like War of the Worlds TV, you know, version.
Yes, exactly.
Because it was ridiculous. Like, and when my eyes and ears don't agree, I turn off my ears. Because I saw a building turn into dust, and they're saying it collapsed. Well, that doesn't make sense, so I just ignored anything that was being said. And I think that often people believe what they're told over what they see.
Do you see that there
I'm very much into making my own observations.
Yeah, you're a scientist and engineer and so forth, but a lot of the public at large out there, they can be deluded, can they not, and misled?
Most people are trained to look at what other people think rather than first begin with what they themselves think. Well, what does so-and-so think about it? Or 4 out of 5 doctors recommend, oh, therefore I should do something. There's a lot of peer pressure. And people often conform to peer pressure. And the engineers around me in that faculty conference room were no different. They were just, easily got swept along with it and felt as though, we got to go get somebody now. Instead of stopping to evaluate what actually happened.
Right, so you're saying they reacted on an emotional basis, like these jihadists have attacked America, and they went for that line, right?
Right, right. And it's interesting, before the second tower got a hole in it, the ticker across the bottom of the screen said something about bin Laden. The line was already there, or the suspicion, or whatever, that somebody fills in the blanks. And what, as a scientist, and also a forensic scientist, an engineer, I know the importance of first determining what happened. You need to first determine what happened before you can determine how it happened. You have to determine what it was that happened before you can determine how it happened. If you start with how, you're assuming a problem, so you're solving an imaginary problem. And then only then can you determine who did it or why they did it. But before noon on 9/11, we were told who and why before what happened was even determined. And that is a trick for convincing, for hoodwinking about anybody, and that's how magic shows are done too, because people then assume the problem. You don't have to prove the problem. They just assume it or imagine it. Yeah, they hate us. Bin Laden did this because they hate us for our freedoms. Bin Laden did it. Did what? What happened has to first be determined. And you think of a magic trick. People are led to assume something, and they end up solving the wrong problem, so they can never solve the actual problem while they're busy assuming the wrong problem. Like, I often talk about a math question. People start arguing about, is the answer 27 or is it 19? Well, it's 27. Is not, is 2. No, it's 19. Is not, is 2. Well, what's the question? Let's look at what the problem is first, and only then can you determine what the answer is. You have to first identify the problem. And in teaching engineering, that's, the very first engineering class, like boot camp, training the students to first establish what the problem is they're going to solve, identify the problem, lay out the data that you're given, and then what information you're looking for. Defining the problem is really important, but the typical person doesn't realize that. And that's how magic shows are performed.
Thank goodness you're an objective person. How did you arrive at being so objective? Was it a trait you had as a young girl or what?
Yeah, I've always been that way. It's, trying to figure stuff out. Why this is that way, just need to know how this works.
Right.
And actually, my first toy, my favorite toy, I found it in trash can so nobody could complain that I was breaking it. It was a Chatty Cathy doll. I don't know if you remember those.
I'm not sure.
You pull a string and the doll talks.
Yeah, okay, okay.
You remember those?
That reminds me of some people.
Right, and the thing didn't work and somebody threw it away. Well,
okay.
They gave me license to take it apart. I wasn't going to damage it, make it any worse.
Right.
And I thought, would you believe they had an actual little miniature record in there? A little stylus on it that plays the record. That was pretty cool.
Well, Charlotte's got a couple of girls, so she's dealt with some of these dolls, I'm sure, right?
Oh, yes. Tickle Me Elmo was our big one.
Oh,
but it didn't have a record on the inside. Yeah.
Right. They have these little, what do you call it, electronic chips, and you can't see how those work. So I feel badly for kids nowadays.
Right, right. So at an early age, you became very objective, and then you carried that through your whole career. And thank goodness you did, because this is an extraordinary book, and it's very objective and very comprehensive. And so how did you get started putting this book together? What year did you really start organizing and getting this book going?
Well, on day one, my colleagues were sucked into this, believing it was a collapse. I tried to get them to see otherwise, and they looked at me like I was Looney Tunes. And I went up to my office, and it was the worst day of my life because, am I insane or is the rest of the world insane? Asking that question is actually the most sane thing to do. How do you establish that? And that's where I came to the billiard ball example. And if you separate the information out into billiard balls, that's in our culture, that's the sign. Put your thinking cap on, billiard balls. So people can have their brain operating.
Okay.
And if you put it in the context of the towers in Manhattan, people's brains don't work. But you give them this billiard ball thing, and I showed this to my colleague, and he looked at me like I was having a senior moment. Of course this is correct. There's no doubt. My math was correct and so forth. But then when you apply it to the World Trade Center towers, the brain stops working and they kind of short circuit. That's when I saw there was a problem. But giving the billiard ball example allows the brain to work on the actual problem and then applies it to, then it shows the connection to the towers. And that's where I learned the power of that. And sometimes, without realizing it, the person is following it along and they don't realize they're painting themselves into a corner they can't get out of. And at the bottom, they realize there's only one conclusion you can come to, that this is not a collapse. There was not enough time for the buildings to actually fall and slam to the ground. And you look at all the other data that's consistent with that, too. But it's to anyone who's not lying to themselves, it becomes irrefutable, to their conscience. That's probably the hardest thing, is to deprogram people.
Right.
So to get this information into people's brains, to understand it, I first had to go through this deprogramming. You have to deprogram and get their brains operational first. But the other things I learned along the way, just showing people evidence isn't the cure, because you know how to cover up irrefutable evidence?
How's that?
Ship it to China? I don't know.
No, you cover up irrefutable evidence by referring to it as a theory or a view or an opinion.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You insert doubt where there is no doubt. It's 2 + 3 equal to 5. Well, that's one person's opinion, but somebody else has this opinion that it's 8. Somebody else has the opinion that 2 + 3 is 9. I guess we'll never know the answer to 2 + 3. We have so many opinions. We don't have a consensus.
Right.
That's in actually the first that I'm aware of industry that used this was the tobacco industry. When there was a connection seen between cigarette smoking and cancer, they couldn't refute that. But they said, that isn't their objective. Doubt is their product. If they create doubt, they win. They don't have to refute the facts. They just create doubt.
Right.
And that's how come so many more people kept smoking, because, well, maybe it won't get them. They were thriving on the doubt. And I have a neighbor who was a victim of that, and he keeps kicking himself. He thought he would, be fine.
Right.
Even though he knew otherwise.
Right. So you're saying, like, the free fall speed of the buildings, right?
I don't say free fall.
What do you say?
Well, you look at the timing.
Yes.
The building didn't, and also the seismic signal and so forth. The building didn't slam to the ground. It didn't even have enough time to.
Okay.
Yeah, it turned to dust in midair.
Right, right. So free fall would be a mischaracterization in this particular case, right?
Right, because it didn't fall.
Right, yeah.
that's another trick that people use. They say, well, the building fell. No, it didn't fall. Or what brought the buildings down? The buildings didn't come down.
Right. The actual mass on the ground of the North and South Tower, and then later on that afternoon of Building 7, how much of the mass was actually on the ground at the end of those, you know?
Well, if you count dust,
okay.
See, you have to wait for all the dust to settle, and you have to collect the dust from the water as well as on the land. But it was, you know, several blocks away from the World Trade Center complex. The dust was ankle deep. And it was deeper the closer you got.
Right.
And also further south. That's a lot of dust. And I made some calculations of, you know, just approximations, and that dust does account for it. If you make a kind of a circle around and extrapolate what you see in the, you know, in the nearby amounts, you can't, of course, collect the dust over the water.
I think in your book, do you maintain that maybe 80% of the North and South was gone from the site, and about 90% of the Building 7 was actually gone and not on the ground, something like that?
Well, there's, you know, it's approximate.
Approximate,
and
sure. Yeah.
Approximately, only about, you know, 20% of each tower was left, North and South Tower.
Okay.
And then you go through the calculations. Now, something was pretty profound. There's no S wave or P wave detected for any of the events that day. That's striking.
And yeah, elaborate on that a little bit for people
that
don't understand those.
Wave,
okay.
Those are waves that travel through the Earth. Like if there's an earthquake somewhere,
okay.
Often you hear that, you know, the P wave arrives first and then the S wave arrives. You know, the primary wave and then the secondary wave.
Oh, okay.
Or shear wave.
Okay, I got it.
And based on the lag between those two, because they travel at different rates through the Earth.
Sure.
You can, you know, the material properties of the Earth. You can say about how far away the epicenter is, and that's how they can pick where the epicenter is, because they have various seismic stations. But with these, no S wave or P wave was detectable. There was only a surface wave. There's really like three kinds of waves. There's the S wave, the P wave, and a surface wave. Now, a surface wave is what you would get, for example, if you get up off your mattress in the morning, you know, the surface of the mattress has changed and it might have some ripple across.
Okay.
Or you know, it springs back.
Sure.
As it spring back. Well, if you remove, each tower was 500,000 tons. If you remove a 500,000-ton weight off the ground, it's going to spring back.
Oh, yes, exactly, yeah.
And it's going to create a some kind of a wave, and it's a surface wave that gets created.
Okay.
From that surface wave, they estimate, you know, the equivalence on a Richter scale reading. And with the South Tower, it was a 2.1, and the North Tower was a 2.3. When they blew up the Seattle Kingdom in controlled demolition, there was an S wave and a P wave, and the surface wave, they calculated the equivalent of a 2.3 on the Richter scale. But the Seattle Kingdom is close to ground, and it's like 1/30th, that's 3 times 10, you know, 1/30th of the potential energy of each of the towers. So
right.
Already we have problems.
Right. So where did the towers go? That you keep coming back to that, don't you?
Yep. Where's the material? And then with Building 7, it made a 0.6 equivalent on the Richter scale.
My gosh.
It's 6 times the potential energy of the kingdom, the Seattle Kingdom, which made a 2.3. So it has a 0.6, which is kind of like, you know, on the order of a jackhammer. And many people had no clue that it went away. And actually, you know, there were 7 buildings destroyed that day, 4 towers, a tower being a building that's taller than it is wide, and Building 3, you know, went away too. Approximately half of it went away during Tower 2's demise, and the other half went away during Tower 1's demise. But there's an EMT, emergency medical technician, who was in one of the buildings and came out, like, was surprised that there's, you know, where'd the building go? And he said, this is a quote, "I don't remember the sound of a building hitting the ground.
Right.
Somebody told me it was measured on the Richter scale. I don't know how true that is. If the building is hitting the ground that hard, how do I not remember the sound of it?
Right. You relate in your book also, weren't there some firemen that survived in the North Tower on round of the stairwell, wasn't around the fourth level
right.
or something? Tell us about that. Relate that a little bit to us, because that's overwhelmingly insightful.
There's one civilian and 13 firefighters.
Okay.
Josephine was the civilian. And Jay Jonas was one of the firefighters. And I've got some quotes by him. He said, I looked and said, guys, there used to be 106 floors above us. And now I'm seeing sunshine. That big building doesn't exist. There's nothing above us.
Right.
And then he later said, these are the biggest office buildings in the world, and I didn't see one desk, one chair, one phone, nothing. Now, they thought they were goners because they're trapped in stairwell B between the second, third, and fourth floor.
Right.
And they figured, you know, nobody'd be able to dig them out under 106 floors of rubble by the time they died.
Right.
And then the dust cleared overhead, and they looked up and saw blue sky, and then walked out.
And that was the overwhelming thing, was it the building up above, it was gone, right?
It was gone, just
yeah.
not there.
Now
and,
what?
In addition to that, they're calling on their walkie-talkies, you know, calling for help. And
okay.
At first, nobody could hear them, but then one of their buddies heard him, and James McGlynn responds and says, we kept telling them we're in B stairwell. I remember everyone had the same exasperation I did. We must have told them 100 times. B stairwell in the second floor, third floor, fourth floor of the North Tower.
Right.
I mean, B stairwell, second, third, and fourth floor, B stairwell, North Tower. Where are you? North Tower, stairway B, second, third floor. You could hear they didn't understand where we were. I keep going, my God, aren't they listening? Then they said, where's the North Tower?
Yeah, gone.
And they said,
I
was like, what do you mean, where's the North Tower? It was unimaginable. Yeah, they probably wondered if the voices were coming from the beyond.
Right.
I used to joke with Morgan Reynolds, you know, I'd say, where's this, where's that? And I said, oh, I know, it's hiding under that hubcap across the street. That's where the building is.
Right. You know,
because that was about all that's left.
You have some video showing some outside structure just turning to dust. I thought that was just a very, very insightful thing.
One more thing that you may not realize. Why I say approximately 80%.
Okay.
The building was turned to dust.
Yeah.
Because if you take the bottom 20% of each tower.
Okay.
We'll say of the North Tower, it left a bigger seismic signal. So it's the bottom 20 stories of that building and the bottom 16 stories of the South Tower. If you turn the rest of it to dust and just dropped that bottom part on the ground, you know, just this even ratio, it's heavier material, and so it actually would be less, but, you know, 20 out of 110 stories.
Sure.
The bottom, so if you drop that to the ground, it would make approximately the same seismic signal, potential energy, you know, as compared to the King Dome.
Right.
So that's where that number comes from, because it seems like that would be equivalent. It's the bottom 16 stories of Tower 2. If you turn the rest to dust and just drop that into its footprint, the bottom 16 stories, you get about the same seismic signal. But that doesn't explain why it doesn't have an S-wave or P-wave. That's even a bigger problem.
Right. You came up with the term dustification of the material.
And one thing I know from forensic engineering, don't call something a term, a known term, if you don't know what the properties are.
Okay.
If you don't know what the process is. If you see some haziness in the air, if you call it smoke, your brain is already assuming it's the cause is a fire.
Right.
And so I just could call it fumes. It
okay.
can be chemical fumes or fumes from a fire. It's a generic term. So I would pick generic terms. Well, if you don't know what the process is of this building turning into dust in midair, you need another word. And the word dustification wasn't used yet, and it seemed very applicable. I think there's no question as to what it means. Or dustify the building. And I think it really needs to go into the dictionary. But it was a placeholder of whatever the process was. So by definition, it can't be wrong. But what we can see is that it cannot be pulverization, because that requires kinetic energy grinding something up. And there's no evidence of that. And it can't be vaporization, because that requires high heat. You know, the building wasn't cooked to death, nor was it beaten to death. So we can rule out the destructive mechanisms. This is important. The destructive mechanisms of kinetic energy and thermal energy.
Right.
The building wasn't beaten to death, nor was it cooked to death. And those 14 people surviving is evidence of that.
Now you
so
talk.
So it's a different process. So I looked at the destructive mechanisms.
Right. You talk about fuming. How does that enter into this dustification?
Well, it was a trait. It's important to just see what is there, not say, well, these are the answers that I know of, like if on a multiple choice test, an eeny, meeny, miny, mo.
Sure.
Process of elimination. You're going to get the wrong answer on this test, because it's not a process you've seen before.
Right.
So it's important to just see what's there. You don't need to explain it. You just need to observe it. There's, you know, fumes coming out of the ground. Even though they were misting the ground with water, there's fumes still coming out. And it wasn't that it was hot. They bring in dirt, put it on it, and then you have fumes coming out of the dirt. And then they scoop up the dirt, take it out, and bring in more dirt. So that was an interesting observation. Some people would jump to a conclusion of that, but I'm just leaving it as the evidence itself. There's also various analyses of the dust as well as the fumes in the air. And they found organic components in the stuff they sampled from the air. That means it can't be high heat. It isn't from you know, something cooking underground. It's a different process. Also, if you take a rock and pound something against it, a hammer and pound something against a rock to break it up, you cannot make particles as fine as what was found. We're talking about particles about 1/100th of the size of red blood cells, or approximately the size of DNA.
My gosh.
0.09 microns or 90 nanometers. You can't get stuff into that size particles by, you know, pounding on a rock with a hammer.
Right.
And so that says kinetic energy was not the destructive mechanism. And the fact that there's organic components in the fumes, it's not, you know, from a vaporization. It's not from high heat. So thermal energy is not the destructive mechanism.
Well, this is
mechanism.
Just fascinating.
Yeah, it is, Charlotte. There's one thing in here. There was a high presence of tritium in the area. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's not sky high, but it was definitely above normal.
Above normal, okay.
You know, way like 50 times above normal, 50 times what normal is.
Would that denote something akin to cold fusion or something like that? In fact, our first program was that when we began the broadcast.
You remembered something about that. That I looked at the various, you know, relative amounts.
Okay.
And that was found in the basement of WTC-6.
Okay.
Which was weird in itself. The middle of building 6 was missing. It was just, you look down to the ground level, there's just no building.
Right.
You
know? Oh, my God.
And but the walls were there around it.
Okay.
But, you know, you look at what leaky nuke plants, you know, hot fission, what that does, and you get sky-high levels of tritium.
Okay.
Tritium has a half-life of about 12 and a half years, I think.
Okay.
So you know, it's not going to be around forever, but there has been atmospheric testing of nuke bombs, but that's, you know, diminished. So that's tapered off. And a good place to measure it is in the Great Lakes. And Lake Superior doesn't have any water running into it where leaky nuke plants would, you know, have anything running into it. So it's, I consider Lake Superior as a good example of what, you know, the background level should be.
I understand.
And what was in World Trade Center 6 was like 50 times background levels.
Right.
And what you get in what's incorrectly called cold fusion, it's low energy nuclear reactions, what's you get from that is about 50 times what was found at the World Trade Center. But what you get from a nuclear event leak, you know, like the hot fission leaky nuke plants, is about 18,000 times.
I see. Okay.
What was at the World Trade Center? So that's you know, a whole different level. But if you you go with LENR, you know, or cold fusion, and water it down, you get approximately what was found at the World Trade Center.
Right.
And, you know, and it's in the neighborhood.
Right. A point you make is the people coming out with the dust all over them, it wasn't hot. They didn't get burned. It was on the cool or cold side. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, people I talked to said it was cooler than ambient temperature.
Okay, so it was cooler than the surrounding air then, right?
Right.
Okay, okay.
Which I thought was kind of weird. Initially it was, and then it felt like probably like they rolled it in some fiberglass, you know, how it itches. And it's all itchy, like it was very, there was some active process going on.
Okay.
And they described trying to wash it off and scrub it off. It was like what they described was like having rolled in a bed of fiberglass insulation. You know, it was pretty uncomfortable trying to scrub it off. And eyes, at the hospital, the main treatment they gave was eye drops.
Oh, my gosh.
People. There wasn't like, you know, burnt people or busted up people. It was just, you know, putting eye drops in.
Right.
And people, you know, who were caught in the dust cloud put their face in their armpit of their shirt, used that as a filter for breathing.
My gosh.
And there's some other, like, interesting comments that here's one by Chief Fire Marshal Richard McKay. He said, somebody actually helped me. I don't know who it was. After somebody said, you know, I can't breathe, someone else said, I don't know which direction it came from, screamed out, don't panic, relax, relax. It's not smoke. It's just dust. Relax. At that point, that's when I started to realize my mouth was filling up like a sandball. All of a sudden, I realized, when whoever said that, now I'm starting to pay attention to my surroundings. I realized there was no heat. You could breathe. Stuff was going in your mouth, but it was like a cool air coming in when you breathed it. So I said, maybe he was right. You know, you couldn't see, but it was gritty.
Right.
So for firefighters, you know, the hazy stuff that looks like smoke, that's death because there's no oxygen in that. Smoke displaces the oxygen. But they realized this had oxygen in it. You could breathe. It wasn't smoke.
Right.
Yeah.
You have this, getting back to this fuming on Building 7, there's a side photograph in your book that shows material coming out. You would state that that was part of the fuming process of some kind?
Which page are you?
I don't have it right in front of me, but the Building 7.
The south face, I remember from ground to roof, you know,
one side
only for most of the afternoon,
yeah,
had this opaque fume coming out.
That's it. Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, fires, they burn one place for a while until they consume all of the fuel, and then they move to another place and consume all the fuel. And it's like 20 minutes or so per place, and it moves through a building. This was solid over the entire face of the building all afternoon.
Okay.
And towards the end, it also was the eastern face of the building. But it was mighty strange. And it was very opaque dust coming out.
Right.
You know, a lot of material coming out. There are also firefighters in Tower 1. This one poor guy, it was his first day out in the field. They call him a probie, you know, probationary.
Okay.
And he's supposed to follow his supervisor around, do everything his supervisor tells him. And so he was, you know, nervously following the supervisor around. They got partway up the stairs, and his supervisor said, stop, drop everything. And that was when Tower 2 was going away. They didn't know what was going on. And then, okay, continue on. They go up the stairs. And after a while, his supervisor said, well, where's your face mask and all? He said, well, you said to drop everything. He's doing exactly what he's told. So
right.
His supervisor said, well, you got to get out of here if you don't have a face mask. And so, you know, he's told to head down the stairs. So he's heading down the stairs. Actually, it saved his life. He's heading down, and he gets to the third floor, and he couldn't see his hand from his face. It was completely black out because all the light was blocked. But he said he could breathe. He realized it was dust. It wasn't smoke. And then he got out of the building and was, you know, just a short distance away, and then Tower 1 went poof. So that was right shortly before Tower 1 went, that the third floor he found was turning to dust.
My gosh.
And he wasn't burning up, of course.
There were anomalies like toasted cars. I think you used the word toasted or, you know.
I don't mean that as in burn.
Right.
It's just it's toast. It's history. It's something just, you know.
Sure, that's the definition you're using in your book. The toasted means it's gone. Or parts of the automobile.
You can't fix it. You got to get a new one.
Right. Like plastic and rubber and stuff like that was gone on the cars. Is that what many of the automobiles experience?
There's different patterns in different places
can
see. And, you know, they're of course, I have people contact me saying, well, don't you see the pattern? It's this type of a car. Look, see if you can find out what make of a car it is. But you have different things happening down different streets. You need more data than that.
Okay.
But also, you know, you could have one car appearing to go into spontaneous combustion next to a car that didn't. But, you know, you can't automatically jump to a conclusion about why that is. But there's a parking lot, 700, 800 feet away from the North Tower, which was the closest building, and there was a sea of unburned paper between the two places. But that car park, you know, had lots of cars that appeared to go into spontaneous combustion. But then afterwards, you look at some of these vehicles, and the plastic trim inside the window is fully intact, but the paint is just, you know, toasted. That's not high heat.
Right.
And also you get, you know, abrupt boundaries, like the front of the car, but not including the door, the front door, just, you know, the engine compartment right up to where the front door is completely toasted, but the door is in pristine condition. Right. And there's somewhere it's the back door that's in pristine condition, the front door is completely toasted, and the inside's completely toasted. But the plastic polycarbonate lights, you know, the police lights on the roof, are not melted. If you're putting those over a hot grill, they're going to melt. So if you had this car, vehicle that was had some rip-roaring fire in it, that's like a hot grill.
Right.
But that didn't happen. It wasn't hot.
Right.
There's no evidence that it was high heat. Some of these apparent fires may have turned into conventional fires, but initially they were not.
Right. FDR Drive, a half a mile away, were there some cars there that were so-called toasted?
There were toasted cars that were seen there, but there was also, you know, I don't know how those got there, but there were vehicles that eyewitnesses saw apparently going into spontaneous combustion. And this one fellow, Alan Cook, said, people try to rationalize, explain it, you know, what they see. And he couldn't understand why the vehicle went into spontaneous combustion. So he decided maybe a fireball rolled down the hill from the towers, or rolled down the street and hit the car. Because why else would the car go into spontaneous combustion down there? It was like right in front of him.
Right. See, many of the the cars, there was like a car parking lot to the northwest, I was thinking. But, oh, I know what I wanted to make a point of. What you're saying about this dustification, the photographic evidence of that in your book is overwhelming. That's really where you did a fine job, Dr.
And,
Wood.
But also, it's not just that. I don't depend on any one piece of data.
Sure.
And there's some people who had sent me some picture of the Building 7 claiming there was a hole through, you know, some grainy frame of one video from one person. I don't pay attention to that. I have to be convinced as though I'm there.
Okay.
And I can reconstruct what it looks like right there, you know, from my left to my right. You know, there's no jumping to conclusions. It's, as I say, keep looking at the evidence until you know what happened. If you don't know what happened, keep looking at the evidence until you do. You know, you let the evidence dictate what happened, not the other way around. And there's some of the evidence, like seismic signal. You know, that's not photographic at all. There's lots of seismic stations, and none of them could pick up any S wave or P wave. Actually, during the demise of Building 7, there's some that couldn't even detect any surface wave, anything out of background noise. But they did pick up a low-level earthquake in the Fox Islands. That's, you know, part of the Aleutian Islands in Alaska. They could pick up a signal from there.
Yeah. What, now, Building 7 was surgically destroyed, was it not?
What do you mean surgically?
I mean, it was across the street from the main location here, and it was between buildings, and none of the buildings to the side or to the north were affected, but it looked like whatever was used, it really took it down just right in that exact location.
Yeah, you've got a point there. But there was a little bit of damage on the side of the Verizon building.
Okay.
That was the one to the west, but it was there before the building's demise.
Okay.
You know, but who knows the exact thing there, but I do know the other side, the post office. You have this 47-story building. It drops, you know, supposedly drops out of the ground without spilling completely across the street. It's not believable. And if it was blown up, like people like to think it was blown up, then you'd have explosions shooting out, you know, at the speed of sound. And so the post office would look machine gun fired.
Right.
It's only three lanes of traffic. It was not. I've been up there and inspected the site. You know, somebody bumped their car into it here or there, but it doesn't have a lot of blemishes on it. But the remaining rubble, there's some bald spots on the sidewalk right next to the post office that weren't completely covered.
Right.
So there's only three lanes of traffic in between a sidewalk on either side of that street. It's just so shocking to think that it's possible even for the building to go down without spilling completely across three lanes of traffic.
Right.
But I think it was just, it appears that there was only a outer facade left. There wasn't really much inside. It was all turned to dust throughout the day.
Right. There was an edifice or a portal of marble. Which building was that the marble was just gone? Did some adjacent building experience that?
There's some patterns of, you know, things in common of material properties.
Okay.
The people leaving Building 1, going down into the lobby, the walls had been covered with marble, but they just crumbled, the marble crumbled off the walls.
Right. I see.
Is what they said.
So there
some
were
weird things with glass. Go ahead.
Yeah, there were just some really anomalies, though, here and there. And were there not holes in some of the surrounding buildings through the glass or something?
You have double pane windows with only the outer pane with a hole in it, and it's a rounded hole, not perfectly round, but rounded. Maybe some were perfectly round, but without any other breaks in the window.
Oh, my gosh.
And so that can't be done with kinetic energy. Yeah. You know, you throw a baseball through a window, and you make a spider web pattern, and you know, it cracks and the cracks run because glass is a brittle material. And it's very weak in tension. And when you know, throw something against it, it bends the window, and that outer surface is under a lot of tension when it bends, and it breaks, and then it, you know, unzips, it cracks. But that didn't happen. It just has round. You have a double pane window, and only one pane has a hole in it.
Right.
Sometimes you get both of them with a hole in it. I'd love to see a high school kid in, you know, his high school physics class raise his hand and say, "Teacher, can you explain to me why when I throw a baseball, it makes a spiderweb pattern in the window, and why does this one make a round hole?"
Right.
That would, you know, upset the teacher's day, probably.
You specify in there that the bathtub, I think there was a deep bathtub and a more shallow bathtub, were not damaged that much. Tell us, our listing on
they were. Yes, they weren't destroyed, which is, you know, quite surprising.
Yes.
The deeper bathtub had the, and bathtub meaning kind of the inverse of a bathtub, a dike that holds out the water, the Hudson. The towers were built on bedrock 70 feet, that's 7 times 10, 70 feet below the water table.
Okay.
And when they built the towers on the bedrock, they put this dike around it, and that became known as the bathtub or slurry wall.
Okay.
And it kept out the Hudson. You'd think if you dropped these big towers down that dike, it would rupture.
Right.
Especially when you take out the stuff inside, and that holds up the walls. You know, it supports them from the inside, because now you have an unsupported wall when you have no material in there. But then when they brought in earth-moving equipment, as it was running around the outer edges of the bathtub wall, it was putting force on the bathtub wall, and that was damaging the bathtub wall, not towers falling on it.
Right.
Uh-huh. Towers allegedly falling on it. So that's another piece of evidence that you didn't have, you know, two 110-story buildings crash down on the bathtub. And actually, when they took down the remains of Building 6, it was an eight-story building, and they just had this little chunk of it next to the bathtub wall. They used cranes to pull it down. They didn't want to use dynamite because it might damage the bathtub wall.
Right.
Yeah, they pull it down with chains.
Yeah, the bathtub on the west bathtub was the one closest to the Hudson River, right? And
right.
So that was the deeper one. And then there was one just east of that was adjacent to it, that was more shallow than the than that western. Is that right? I'm thinking.
Yeah, it was, it had building four and five in it.
Yeah.
The smaller buildings.
And then the only building that was not on
the reason why it was that way is, you know, that the old shoreline was inside of that. It was right, well, about where that wall was.
Okay.
It was the old shoreline. But they had subways that went underneath through there.
Okay.
So that's why they needed a wall initially.
Right.
It was the early 1900s when they built that. And, you know, the subway wasn't damaged. It wasn't destroyed. I won't say it wasn't damaged. Going under the Hudson, that went under the towers.
Right.
And actually, in February of 2002, when they dug down to that level, they pulled out some of the subway cars.
Really?
They weren't crushed.
Gosh.
There's a couple of them were damaged. Out of seven cars, I think, there's a couple of them were damaged, but there's some that I think four of them were not. And so they put them in the museum. But they're right underneath the towers.
Right. The retail in there, was it damaged much, some of the retail stores in there, in that area?
Well, it depends. If you had computer equipment, you wouldn't want all that dust in there.
Sure,
but
I got you.
It was dusty. Yeah, very dusty.
Oh, okay.
Right afterwards, when they're looking for survivors, they're walking down through that mall, and they're standing straight up. You could read, you know, Innovation Luggage, Hallmark cards. You could tell where these guys were walking, looking for survivors.
Right, right.
And he had books knocked off the shelves, some bookshelves knocked over, and dust everywhere. And there was one zone where, you know, something punched through a little bit. And this is one level below street level.
Okay.
But the next level down or so, it wasn't damaged.
Right. Well, I tell you what, your book is just overwhelmingly educational and insightful. And you, how long did it take you to put this book together? How long did you spend?
A while. Well, it was over a bunch of time, and then getting it published was another challenge in itself.
Okay.
Probably what would surprise people the most was, you know, the majority of the time is spent on the figures. Hunting for figures and preparing them. You've probably noticed, you know, there's a lot of arrows. You know, I look here.
Okay.
And putting the arrow on it where it won't obstruct your view and getting the color right so it doesn't distract from the rest of the picture.
Okay.
But to show, to be able to show what's where and, you know, a picture is worth 1,000 words, so over 800 pictures and diagrams in there. That's,
right.
It's worth
And then there's an insert that on the book that I received. I think, Charlotte, did you get the insert in yours too?
I did. Yes, I did.
That insert was very, very – I've just sat around tables and handed that to people to get them started on your book and talking about it. And that insert was very, very insightful about what was left there on the ground, you know.
It also, yeah, it's a kind of a bookmark with handy things.
Yes.
Like about how long the ground shook or when it, you know, happened and the equivalent seismic signal, how long it, you know, the duration of it. Or the other one where the photograph side where,
yes.
It shows the number of stories in the building.
Yes, yes. That was because you could see the layout, you know, and know where the buildings had been, you know, and then flip over there and see what was left after the event, you know. And it was very, very insightful and helpful as a tool to try to begin to understand what had happened there.
And the WFC2 building, that's the one with the rounded dome on the top?
Yes.
As World Financial Center, not WTC, WFC2. If you have, it's a 44-story building. If you have a 110-story building across the street that falls down, collapses, wouldn't you expect to see some beam or something clobber the top of that and get it dinged up?
Yeah. Yeah, you would, wouldn't you? No, my gosh.
And I've also pictures in my book of a Boeing 767 of the tail, the stabilizer, where they, you know, they do an engine run up to full throttle before the engine, before the plane takes off.
Yes.
So this poor pilot, instead of waiting for the concrete pad where they're supposed to do the engine run up, he did it on the tarmac. And just the wind, strong wind coming out of the engines tore up the tarmac. Pulled up pieces that blew holes in the tail of the plane.
Oh, my gosh.
Destroyed it.
Yeah.
And that's not over, you know, like 300 miles an hour even. So how do you get explosions? You know, you get little pieces of something with an explosion that would go flying. Or even if it's a collapse, you would get pieces being shot out of the side of the building.
Right. Right.
And so all adjacent buildings around there would look machine gun fired, but they don't.
Yeah.
So that's another piece of evidence.
Go ahead, Charlotte.
Well, I was going to ask about the Hutchinson effect and how you came to make that connection to possibilities. That's all. I too stumbled during my internet research about the Hutchinson's effect. If I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Hutchinson.
Hutchinson. What is your understanding of that effect and how it's potentially, you know, groundbreaking and important?
Well, after looking at all of the evidence, and, you know, I just categorized, again, I wasn't jumping to any conclusions or trying to force fit this information into any particular hole. I just knew all these categories of data, like weird fires that aren't hot. And, you know, hot things glow, but not everything that glows is hot. And you see this glowing thing on a piece of paper, and the paper's not burning. You know, piece of evidence like that. I happened upon a blog one night where somebody had reproduced every single one of these effects, including metal that was bent more than 180 degrees. It was just curled without any kinks or buckles in it. And, I've got to get a hold of this guy. And, you know, having lived some years in Missouri, you know, the show me state, as you know, I got to go see it for myself. Now, you read about Tesla having invented this, that, and the other, but those, as I call them, are stories. It's probably true, but, you know, you're having to take somebody else's word for it. But John Hutchison lives in the here and now, and you can go visit him and see for yourself. So that's what I did. And, you know, evaluated specimens and so forth. And saw it all for myself. That it was, you know, there's no easier way to believe something. Now, I call this parallel evidence. Just like looking at an incandescent light versus a fluorescent light, you know, one's hot and one's not, but they both glow. That's an example of hot things glow, but not everything that glows is hot. Mm-hmm. And we saw that similar things happening at the World Trade Center, you know, in the following days, like something glowing that wasn't hot. So we know we're not imagining it. If somebody needs to see an example of that in another setting, and I tried to find examples of things that everyone has experience with, or, you know, nearly everyone. If you have electricity, you probably do have experience with
right,
it.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And then also like tornadoes, the similarities. Just looking at things we know and making observations, just learning how to observe and seeing parallel evidence to try to get a better understanding of it. So what John Hutchison does is create a static field. And within the static field, he intersects various radio frequency signals, you know, typically microwaves.
That's just fascinating.
And then these weird things happen. Sometimes, you know, stuff flies up, and sometimes it you know, comes apart into powder.
Right. We're about 2 minutes away from the end of our first hour this evening. And I'd like to try to pick up, well, we can pick up the John Hutchison effect stuff at beginning on the second hour, if that's okay with you, Dr.
Sure.
Wood, and go from there. But, boy, I tell you what, it's been educational, hasn't it, Charlotte?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
It's fascinating.
Your book is just phenomenal.
It is.
Yes.
I can't say but give you glowing reports on your book. You've taken so much energy and work and my gosh, it's just a wonderful book, and we certainly highly recommend that to everyone. We have all of your click-offs on your where to get your book, on your homepage, and everything else, so they can easily, you know, purchase your book. And I can only recommend it the most highly.
Where did the towers go? And that's the question that everyone should have been asking.
Yes.
Where did the towers go?
Yes, exactly. And yeah, well, you couldn't have said it any better, Dr. Wood. You know that?
I have to give credit to George Stephanopoulos and Peter Jennings.
Okay.
24 or 25 hours after the event on the 12th.
Okay.
Peter Jennings is in the studio and George Stephanopoulos is at the site. And Peter Jennings says, George, Jackie Judd and several others have been asking, where did all the rubble go?
Yes.
And George says, oh, I've been asking people that. And one volunteer, Robert Grulinski, explained it all fell down into the ground, was pulverized.
Yeah. Boy, sure. Well, look, thank you for this first hour, and we'll come back and get right back on this, John Hutchison. I want you to finish that story also, because that's very, very interesting. That the way that you've picked up stuff from everyone, you learned from everyone, haven't you?
Yep.
Okay.
It's about being able to observe.
Okay. Well, we're going to close out this first hour now, and thank you very much for being with us this first hour. We're going to take a break at the top of the hour for a few minutes, and then we'll come back and pick up your story, and then also the John Hutchison will elaborate a little bit on that. But thank you very much for being with us this evening, this first hour. Dr. Judy Wood, we certainly appreciate everything you've done. We'll be right back.
You're very welcome.
Okay.